Hello, my oral surgery friends. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. In this podcast, you will hear surgeons discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. The goal of this podcast is to evaluate every aspect that a surgeon can improve in order to create a better experience for patients, staff, and the surgeon. Most of the information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions. The methods discussed are meant to provoke thought and should be supplemented with research into the approved studies prior to making changes to one's way of practice. Without further ado, please enjoy this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. Welcome to another episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. This is Dr. Grant Stuckey. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elda Fisher. She is an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in North Carolina and is currently the director of the UNC program. Is that correct?
That's right, Grant. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for joining us. I'm so excited to talk to you today. First question is if you can just give us a brief history of your training and then how you got to where you're at.
Oh, yeah. Super circuitous route, really. But I went to undergraduate on the East Coast and never really thought about going to dental school until I was waiting tables in Maine and in a PhD program and thought to myself, well, that sounds like a good career. So that's when it popped into my head. So I went to dental school in New Jersey at Rutgers, which at the time was UMDNJ, School of Acting. Okay. Right after dental school, I went to residency at UNC here in Chapel Hill. I did a cosmetic surgery fellowship and full body cosmetic surgery in Columbus, Ohio. Came back here and I opened my own practice in aesthetic surgery. And I also supervised the residents as an adjunct faculty and working at the VA in Durham. After doing all that, as my aesthetic practice grew, I started seeing, you know, a variety of different patients looking for aesthetic services. And at the same time, this opportunity at UNC opened up to be the program director. And I've been here for about 2 years now.
Excellent. Well, that's great. I have to ask, was the fellowship with Dr. Evans or who were you with?
Yes, my fellowship was with Bill Evans, one of the most interesting people in the world. He should definitely be on one of those beer commercials.
Yes, I love him. He was gracious enough to come to our program at the University of Illinois, Chicago with Dr. Maloro. And at least while I was there, I don't know if he's still doing it, but he would do at least a couple days a month teaching us cosmetic stuff. But yeah, he's like the Dos Equis guy of oral surgery.
He really is. He has some unbelievably great stories. And my time as a fellow, I have great stories from that time too. It's for another podcast. You could do a whole podcast on, you know, craziness that happens to you when you're a fellow.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh my goodness. As a program director and at UNC, what types of surgeries are you focusing on or what's your main thing?
Yeah. So, you know, I obviously wanted to have a practice that was largely aesthetic. And when I had my aesthetic surgery practice, it was interesting because I had a very boutique aesthetic surgery practice. I had concierge medicine. I would often go to people's place of work. I charged a lot of money for the traveling services and did Botox or filler or a consult for surgery. And then I would do their aesthetic surgery at sort of an outpatient aesthetic surgery center. And I really enjoyed that. But in doing that, I met some patients that were transgender and they were looking for transgender facial surgery and gender affirmation surgery. And these were my early patients were all male to female. And I really enjoyed what we could do from an injectable standpoint, right, with just filler and Botox. But then we expanded it to do cheek implants or mandibular angle reduction. And I really enjoyed working with the population and making those changes. And so when the position here at UNC opened up, I was really excited because they had just started a transgender health program. And so now I try to focus my practice as much as possible on doing gender affirmation surgery.
Excellent. That's awesome. That's got to be a fairly small niche in oral surgery, right? Or are there more than I think?
I have to say, yeah, I think within oral and maxillofacial surgery, it is a relatively small niche. I don't know that many people doing it. However, I think it's definitely in the wheelhouse of the oral and maxillofacial surgeon. And it's certainly something that we all should be well-versed on doing. One of the things that always shocks people when I tell them is the actual number of transgender people living in the United States. Because you think that, well, maybe this is just a really small population and there aren't enough patients that would be interested in this surgery. But the reality is that there's about 0.6% of the U.S. population that identifies as transgender, meaning that the gender assigned at birth is not congruent with the gender they feel they are. Okay. And that is the same number of people that have type 1 diabetes in the U.S. So think of all of the patients that you've seen in your time as a surgeon that have had type 1 diabetes, and replace that in your mind with patients that have gender dysphoria or transgender. And think of the number of patients that you would need to treat. And so I think it's a really underrepresented population in our minds, but not a underrepresented population as a whole.
Got it. Wow. And that's really interesting. And it's also great you're able to help and serve them, because I'm sure there's not a ton of providers, like you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the biggest problems in providing gender affirmative care is that, number one, there's an access to care problem. So this particular group of patients usually has a hard time sort of broaching that access to care, finding someone that knows what they're doing, that understands facial affirmation surgery, or just really understands the differences between the male and female craniofacial skeleton. And so in general, maxillofacial surgeons really understand the differences between the male and female craniomaxillofacial skeleton. And I would postulate better than most other specialties that operate in the head and neck, because we spend time learning Riolo's numbers and doing our orthognathic assessments and changing our orthognathic planning based on whether the patient is male or female. So it's really something that is, like I said before, in the wheelhouse of the oral and maxillofacial surgeon. And then the question that you posed, which is exactly right, is that, well, most oral and maxillofacial surgeons aren't getting exposed to this population, right?
Yeah.
So really, there's just like a connectivity problem where the transgender health programs at some of these major institutions aren't really reaching past into the oral and maxillofacial surgery group to offer their services. I think the second part is that this is just a generally disenfranchised population. Mm-hmm. If you think about the people that identify as transgender, many times they've had challenges earlier in life. I think it's getting better now. I think it's a little bit easier to grow up transgender now because there are more resources. But I think when you're talking about a 40 or 50 or 60 year old patient who has, you know, identified or had been transgender, for a large portion of their life, they've been disenfranchised and not had the same opportunities for jobs, or maybe a job that has insurance or the same type of social stability that you would normally find.
Yep. Well, it's really interesting to bring that up and kind of paint that picture of probably a lot of people.
It's a huge number of people. Most of the lower body services, right, for gender affirmation are covered by insurance.
Okay.
Almost routinely covered by all insurances if you want lower body gender affirming care. Hmm. If you want chest augmentation, breast augmentation, mastectomy for gender affirming care, that is largely covered by insurance companies. And really the only thing right now that is difficult to get covered is the facial surgery aspect. You know, you reach another hurdle. So if I have a patient that we cannot get insurance coverage for, the types of surgery that we do for facial gender affirmation surgery, if they're not just Botox and filler and like small things that you can do office-based, if we're doing some skeletal recontouring, you know, that comes with a pretty hefty price tag and an overnight hospital stay, which most people, including myself, probably can't afford out of pocket. Right.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That really dwindles things down. But I think as more and more insurance companies start to realize that the way that someone's facial appearance looks is really, really important to these feelings of gender dysphoria, the more likely they are to cover these procedures. And ultimately, the procedures that are on the head and neck, the face, the recontouring, you know just as well as I do that overall cost to the hospital is much less for that than it is to have a free flap surgery to create a phallus.
Yep. Are there many studies out there showing cognitive, mental benefits, you know, to these types of patients to have these surgeries or things like that?
Yeah, I mean, there are several studies out there demonstrating the positive effect on mental health from facial feminization surgery in general. But I think the biggest problem with the types of studies, you know, I have a pending IRB right now, but the types of research that's aimed at this patient population is that we're really looking at quality of life studies and like healthcare related quality of life studies. And when you look at healthcare-related quality of life, it's very hard to get a large amount of funding for those studies because they're not scientifically based. Quality of life studies really aren't supported by the NIH. And so that makes it a little bit challenging to do high quality research in the area.
Got it. Okay. Could see how that would be challenging to quantify that and get it funded and just go through all those hoops.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge, but it's really a fun population to work with. And so, like I said, I really got started just out of Office Space. Like, what can I do to help this person look more feminine? And, you know, if there are, and I know you do an Everyday Oral Surgery podcast, so if there are oral surgeons out there thinking about, well, you know, what can I do to help this population or to get them the right treatment? The simplest things are these soft tissue measures to sort of feminize a face or masculinize a face. And when you're looking at the soft tissue, you know, we're looking to arch the eyebrows, easy to do with Botox, right? And so you can offer some Botox to arch the eyebrows a little bit more. If you're looking at the Ogee curve and how a woman's face is, you know, more tapered, I mean, you can certainly add filler volumization to the cheeks, or in several cases, I've placed cheek implants for that so that you can feminize the cheeks themselves and create a more tapered face, facial look. You know, you can do rhinoplasty or liquid rhinoplasty if that's something you're interested in. Lip surgery is a really fun surgery for oral and maxillofacial surgeon. That's totally in our wheelhouse. It's right around the lips, right? And you can just do a quick lip lift in the operation. It's something we don't get to do all the time when we're in a regular oral surgery practice, but it's a great operation and it's really beneficial because the masculine lip, like from subnasale to the Cupid's bow area, is longer than women. So it does make a difference.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, another question is, where do you start with this population as far as trying to figure out an end goal? You know, because the regular person who wants cosmetic surgery, usually they bring in a picture of them 20 years before and they say, make me look like this.
You're like, that doesn't work. I think that's the great thing about this population, is that really, like, you are the vision of what they're going to look like. You have a good sense as the surgeon of, like, what is so masculine here and what is more feminine? What can I build off of? And so I think that the patient not coming in with specific expectations of looking like they did when they were 16 is really valuable, right? Because you can make so many great improvements and the patients actually recognize those improvements. And they can be small, like I said, from Botox to filler. Adam's apple reduction is a quick, easy in-office procedure if you'd like to do that, to doing the coronal flap and recontouring the frontal orbital rim.
Okay. Do a lot of these patients come in like with an idea, or are you kind of guiding them and saying, hey, here's where we could go? Or do they show you pictures? I mean, how does it?
So they don't usually show pictures because they can't really picture themselves as the gender that they intend to be, but they do have areas that they think are problematic. And so recently I had a patient that said, doesn't my jaw look wide? And she's right. Her jaw is super wide. It's, you know, it doesn't pass for a feminine jaw, even though the rest of her face really passed for feminine. Okay. And so sometimes they have a good idea of what the problem is. And other times you have to guide them to what is going to really help overall.
Okay. That's great. And what great exposure that must be for your residents and people you're working with. Do you have them helping? Do you have fellows, or who's all assisting you?
So it's just the residents. And yeah, they do get some interesting exposure to cases that they would not normally see. The transgender health program here at UNC was started, I want to say, like 2.5 years ago, and it already has over 500 patients in it. And so It's a large, large volume of patients that we're seeing that want to at least be evaluated for these services.
Wow, that's tremendous. Very good. Are you just strictly cosmetic, or are you also
as a program director, you do a little bit of everything. So I still have that same, like, the big OKC, you know, all of those
cases. Trauma.
Trauma.
Infections.
So works. Yeah, plenty of infections. But yeah, I found that this area has been really personally rewarding. I mean, I don't have any close ties to the transgender community, but I have found that I really enjoy working with this patient population because they are so grateful. And I really get to use the skills that I have from my training, both as a cosmetic surgeon, but also as an oral and maxillofacial surgeon, someone super comfortable operating on the craniofacial skeleton. When patients come in and we're going to do a genioplasty or a mandibular angle reduction, I don't really think there's any other better doctor to do that than the oral and maxillofacial surgeon. I think a lot of doctors can do it very, very well, but I certainly think that we should all be well-versed in that type of care. Same with the frontal orbital setback. One of the primary operations that we do for facial feminization surgery is make a coronal approach to the frontal orbital rim and then decrease the frontal orbital projection so that the angle at nasion is less acute, which it's very acute in the masculine skeleton. There's a lot of frontal orbital bossing. A female skeleton, it's more rounded, and the forehead itself is just a little bit straighter. And so to make those changes both in that frontal region, either with an anterior frontal sinus setback or with just a plasty and osteoplasty of the site there, if there's not a lot of frontal sinus left, and then the lateral superior orbital rims can be recontoured, that gives, you know, a little bit of a brow lift on its own, opens up the orbits, and you can see that change almost immediately. I usually do that in conjunction with a brow lift and some hairline lowering. But those are changes that the patient really can't point out. What is it about their eyes and their forehead and their nose that looks masculine? But, you know, you and I, as people that are looking at people's faces every single day and evaluating for orthognathic surgery or cosmetic surgery, you know, have a good sense of why somebody looks more masculine than somebody else.
Yep. For the resident or the dental student, girls who are thinking they would want to go into this profession, but are concerned about the social aspect of it. In one regard, communicating with patients. And we talked a little bit about this with some other cosmetic surgeons we had. Are you aware of Kevin Haddle? He also was trained by Dr. Evans, but he was on the podcast. But I was going to get your take. What do you say to young surgeons, young students that are looking to go into it, but are kind of afraid of having those extra social abilities that you need to communicate with these patients and, you know, walk them through this whole scenario? Because it's more involved than taking out third molars.
Yeah. I mean, walking them through is really just a practice in setting expectations. So that's step one, right? And that's really for any surgery that you're going to make a big move on. Even when you have an orthognathic consult, you're like, let me set your expectations for the timeline of this orthognathic surgery that you are embarking on.
Yeah.
Cosmetic surgery, let me set your expectations for what we can do non-invasively versus with surgery, right? And so you really have to be clear with patients about what the expectation should be. I think the nice thing about this particular patient population is that they really defer to you on the expectation. And I have typically run this practice slowly, not like an all-in-one setting, like let's get your face to be a female, but really slowly and methodically. And that's partially because I think that's the right way to do it. But it's also partially because we spend so much time working with insurance to get approval for the tracheoplasty, to get approval for this, you know, writing appeals. And so the process itself has limited how quickly I can make these changes for patients. And I think overall that has been better because these slow changes are better, I think, socially overall. Mm. They're appreciated by the patients on an individual basis. They give you a little more time to concentrate on that one particular area that you want to fix. And I think it's easier on the patient when the overall outcome is not just a shock to their friends, family, and support system. And so this gradual change, I think, has been really helpful for most of my patients.
That's awesome. You just seem naturally like you're good at talking to people and can navigate all of this.
No, I'm just as nervous as everybody else that comes on your show, Grant.
Well, no, I mean, but I think that there is, you know, that hesitancy, even just going into cosmetics in general.
Right.
Gosh, can I do this? Can I talk to these patients? I don't want to say sell it, but, you know, most of the cosmetic surgeons we know are just really good at that aspect.
I think the thing that should calm the listeners down a little bit here is that I think one of the problems with cosmetic surgery and going into cosmetic surgery as an oral and maxillofacial surgeon is that you always feel a little bit like you're under a lot of scrutiny by other types of surgeons, right? Whether it's plastic surgeon or ENT, facial plastics, oculoplastics, you know, there's a lot of competition for that area. And I think that we can all do an excellent job on soft tissue surgery of the face and, you know, anti-aging interventions. And, you know, certainly a lot of people take different approaches to that. When you're looking at changes to the craniofacial skeleton itself or implants, you know, in the cranium maxillofacial skeleton, I really think that most oral and maxillofacial surgeons like feel deep down inside that this is what they are trained to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have that level of comfort with your own skills in this area that you may not have as much if you're sort of delving out and competing with other specialists in soft tissue surgery. But certainly there aren't a lot of other surgeons that really want to do bony recontouring, genioplasty, angle reductions, you know, tracheoplasty, anterior frontal sinus setback. Those plating surgeries, those cutting surgeries on the skeleton, most of their surgeons like to operate soft tissue. And so really oral and maxillofacial surgeons are the ones that are, you know, super comfortable on the periosteum, right? Or under the periosteum. Mm-hmm. And I happen to know that when my residents, you know, they cut down and once they get to bone, they turn into big cowboys, right? It's right when they get to bone, they start like, big cowboy surgery. So I think that it just demonstrates that it's the plane that we are most comfortable in, the most comfortable assessing. We spend a lot of time looking at these skeletal contours, the projection, the numbers, SNA, SNB, really figuring out what's right on a patient, the bigonial angles, the bizygomatic width, and seeing the problems from a skeletal basis. And when I did my cosmetic surgery training, as you know, Bill Evans, extraordinaire oral and maxillofacial surgeon, also ER doctor, also critical care doctor, but he really emphasized that the first thing you do is look at the skeletal framework of the patient, and you have to correct skeletal deformities before you do anything else. And I think, you know, the oral and maxillofacial surgeon is the prime person to do those things. And in reality, the patients that need gender affirmation surgery, you know, the primary issue is a skeletal problem. The skeleton has had its maturation events during puberty, and the effects of testosterone on the skeletal framework of the craniofacial skeleton have given them a larger nose and a frontal orbital bossing area and, you know, wider bigonial width. And so it's those things that we're highly attuned to and could correct easily.
How much of your training in orthognathic surgery helped you for what you're doing now?
I mean, I don't know if I can quantify how much it helped me, but so we do a lot of orthognathic surgery at UNC. It's a big component of the residency program here. And it's hard for me to quantify how much of that helped me in my cosmetic surgery practice and how much helped me in this gender affirmation surgery. But I have to say it's got to be an enormous component, because understanding the way the face is supposed to look in an ideal world is the key to being able to be a good cosmetic surgeon and to be a good gender affirming surgeon. That is the thing that's most important out of orthognathic surgery. And then the second part is the treatment planning. So orthognathic surgery, you look at your patient and you develop a diagnosis, like a problem list, and then you develop a treatment plan. And the same is true in doing facial feminization surgery or mass feminization surgery. You develop your problem list, and then you develop an itemized treatment plan to treat those problems. And I think that just basing it that way makes a huge difference, you know, having that type of training to look at things that way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Are there any orthognathic procedures that you do for facial changes?
You can combine facial gender affirmation surgery with orthognathic surgery. And so Probably the primary one that you would do is a BSSO or some kind of mandibular setback, because as you know, the masculine jaw is significantly more projected. And so you'd want to see, like in a more feminine phase, probably clockwise rotation of the maxillary mandibular complex, if possible, right? And then A narrowed chin. So you want to do a genioplasty with chin narrowing, where you take out the middle section of the bone in the chin and replace that. And, you know, we do all of that now with 3D planning, right?
Nice.
So that makes the whole process really comfortable, because we plan all of the surgeries with the 3D guided planning and custom plates or custom cutting guides if necessary.
So awesome. So much better than those old models that we used to make and all that ridiculous sawing and cutting. And
I know, right? When I started here at UNC as an intern, we used to spend a lot of time in the lab. And I spent a lot of time in the lab throughout my residency program here. And I think they spend a lot less time now because they have mostly the 3D guided splints made out of house. But there's a little thing in our lab that says, welcome to hell. And when I got here, I thought, oh gosh, that's terrible. And by the time I was a chief resident with an infant, you know, and being in that lab at 2 o'clock in the morning, I thought to myself, I really did come here. I have arrived.
Oh my gosh. That's so great. I mean, I'm sure the feminization, masculinization procedures teach different things and probably apply, you know, residents, people who are learning with you and seeing things are like, oh yeah, that also helps me with orthodontic surgery, or orthodontic surgery helps me with this. And it's probably interconnected.
You know, I think it's important to think about, you know, am I treating as someone who wants to look feminine, or am I treating someone who wants to look masculine? You know, even when you're doing your regular orthodontic surgery workup, right? Because, you know, many times we don't really consider that. I certainly didn't when I was a resident. I wasn't thinking about the fact whether or not this patient had gender dysphoria, or the 17-year-old, you know, really wanted to look more feminine or more masculine. We just went by the norms, right? And we treated towards those standardized norms. And now it's something to consider, particularly when you think about the population of people, again, that have gender dysphoria and believe that they are a gender that they were not assigned at birth. And so recently I had a colleague of mine do an orthodontic surgery on a patient, and the patient was male and he performed the orthodontic surgery, but the patient was like, you know, moments away from changing gender altogether to female. And so the orthodontic surgery itself was highly successful, except that it masculinized the patient's face. And so it's really something to think about that we don't typically consider. And it might just be as easy as putting like a questionnaire, you know, beforehand, being like, what are your goals for your face? Do you want to look more masculine, more feminine? Like, do you think that your chin is too big, too small? Like, just as a generalized thing, not to scare people, right? Not to alienate your patients, but to make sure that it's available to do that for them.
That would be awesome. I think that's a great idea, and really paying attention as the provider to the questionnaire, taking all that stuff seriously and talking with the patient about all their expectations.
Yeah.
Super important. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about is in regards to things you have learned as a program director and your position as a teacher now for other students.
I think that I've learned, you know, I have very high expectations of people. Mm-hmm. And I think that anybody that knows me will tell you that I have very high expectations of the people around me. And I think that that's really important, and that people usually rise to the level of expectation. I mean, they almost always rise to the level of expectation. Children also, right?
Yep.
But I think that it may be a mistake to do that uniformly in a practice, right? Because the expectations that I have of myself, those may not be the expectations that I should have of a particular resident or a particular staff member at a particular time, right?
Okay.
So I think, you know, you really have to take those expectations into context, right? And so certainly what I expect of myself, I can't expect of the person that runs the front desk. We have a different lifestyle and two different goals in life. And, you know, we're at work for different reasons, right?
Yeah.
And what I expect of myself, I can't always expect of my residents. I can tell them that, you know, eventually you should expect this of yourself. But to expect it throughout the residency program may be quite demanding on a lot of parts of their life. It has taught me that. And I think the other thing that it has taught me is that perceptions are very important, because when I look at a resident and I see how they're doing, you know, I make my assessment. Dr. Turvey makes his assessment. Dr. Blakey makes his assessment. We're all looking at this resident, right? And they come in my office and I give them feedback, and they're blown away that the feedback is bad, right? Or that there's criticisms of them. And sometimes I am too. Sometimes I'm like, I would never have thought this about you. But the reality is that it doesn't matter if they are performing well or are performing well, as much as, you know, in some cases, like, is that perception there? So it doesn't really matter if you're reading every night when you go home, if other people around you don't think that you are, because it's somehow it's not getting across that you are doing that, right?
Exactly.
And so perceptions really do matter. And so to just say, I don't care what other people think, is really not beneficial to how you want to progress.
Yes. So you're saying teaching that to your residents, because it's one thing to be doing something. It's another thing to transmit the fact that you did such a thing, right?
Exactly. And that's really hard. You know, some of my residents, you know, they get comments like, oh, he seems disinterested. And, you know, the resident's like, I'm not disinterested. It's like, but you seem disinterested. And so that is the problem, right? Because if you seem disinterested, the same opportunities are not provided to you as someone who's interested. And that's just the fact of the way people work.
For sure. I've said this before on our podcast, but you know, when I first started residency, it was a tough go for me for the first few months. I was in an environment that to me seemed very hostile and scary. A lot of people, you're on the microscope all the time. And you feel like sometimes you can get in a state of paralysis, analysis paralysis, you know, where you're just so terrified to make a wrong decision that you can almost not even make a decision.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And things, and it's a cycle, and it gets worse and worse. I was grateful, you know, to have good directors and chairmen who took time to sit me down and say things like, hey, it seems like you, you know, are struggling with this. You could benefit with this. Maybe you should do X, Y, and Z to improve your lifestyle.
I think someone watching really helps, right? But I think you know, the key thing that I try to let the residents know is that residency, it's like a series of very uncomfortable events. It's just like, it's not a really comfortable position. And it's great when you have a residency group that's cohesive and can support each other. But all those times that you're pimped on rounds or whatever, that is so that you become very comfortable with that feeling of being uncomfortable. That's so that when you get that little adrenaline surge, you're very used to it. So that when something scary happens in the operating room or you hit the IJ or, you know, you can't control the bleeding from the retromandibular vein, that little surge of adrenaline is something your brain is already quite used to. And so it's normal to feel extremely anxious and uncomfortable many times during the residency program. But as you go on, you start to get far more comfortable with that, and you can calm down much easier when situations like that happen.
Yep, for sure. I'm sure it's got to be a balance for you in your position as director between criticizing, telling people, you know, what's wrong, and also trying to point out what's good and saying, good job with that, you know?
Right. I mean, I do like listening to podcasts. Some of them that I've listened to talk about like women in leadership or having leadership roles. And I listened to a podcast recently on delivering feedback. So I don't really know how to get feedback. I will tell you that when I was a resident, I didn't really get any feedback, right? It was just a guessing game. And now I really try to schedule routine feedback. The podcast told me that I should ask the resident, what kind of feedback do you want? Do you want just positive feedback? Do you want verbatim what people wrote about you? Do you want me to, like, you know, sugarcoat the feedback? People really present it to the resident as what is the right feedback for you in this particular time. And I took that advice with the resident, and the resident asked for, I want the verbatim feedback. And that wasn't a great idea. So I think really, you know, everyone says make a compliment sandwich. And I think, you know, it's important to really highlight residents' strengths. And certainly by this time in the program, you know, people have gone through undergraduate, sometimes a GPR, part of a residency program. They're highly qualified. And so I think it's really important to point out the areas that they really add to the team, whatever that might be, and let them know that criticism is really for their own benefit. And so when they hear these critical remarks, it's really hard not to take it personally. But overall, it is better for you in the long run to know that these are the thoughts, perceptions about you so that you can work on changing them. Because ultimately, my goal for the resident is that they are happy residents. They feel comfortable in their surgical skills and they become excellent independent surgeons in whatever realm of oral and maxillofacial surgery they want to do. And I want them to be comfortable at home, too. I want them to have, and you know what it's like to have a whole bunch of kids at home, right? I mean, it's a really hard balancing act to do all of that stuff. You know, it shouldn't be a balance. It should be that one complements the other, really. And you know, I feel like I'm a better mom because I'm a surgeon and a residency program director. And I feel like I'm a better surgeon and a better residency program director because I'm a mom. Right. And I think they really both complement each other a lot. And you really have to sort of add things in that help you.
Yeah, that's awesome. I like what you're saying about the student, the one who's learning and in the process, recognizing that any guidance, criticism, whatever it is, whatever form it comes in, you know, we have to be able to process that and say, this is for my benefit. This isn't a personal attack, you know, and it's hard to do that when you haven't been in those situations in the past, to not take everything personally and to just start crying, you know?
Right. It really is hard to do it. You know, certainly like when people, you know, when I've had my own troubles, or like if I, you know, think my surgical outcome is not as good, I'm highly self-critical. It's really hard to get past those things, but it's going to come over and over again in life. So it's better to get learn how to deal with it as a resident.
Totally agree. Well, I really appreciate that. And that's great, I think, feedback for most of our listeners. Most are young surgeons, residents, students. And we call it having thick skin, but it's more than just being able to take, you know, what we think is verbal abuse. It's really the real progress that happens when you say, hey, what is the truth behind that criticism? What, you know, what's being said, and what can I take and change? That's when you start growing, as opposed to, you know, okay, I'll just suck it up and take this criticism and, you know, not show emotion, but, you know, not really internalize the feedback at all. That's a mistake as well. You need to.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you really have to kind of mull it over a little bit. Give yourself some time with it. Don't be mad right away.
Exactly.
And remember that some people are just jerks. And so, you know.
Right. True.
you know, there's always a percentage of people that fit into that category also.
Yep. For those guys and gals who are wanting to go into academics, do you recommend becoming a director, or is this more problem than it's worth?
No, I mean, I love my position. I love my job. I love my residents. I've always wanted to be in academics. You know, I had my private practice, but I kept getting drawn back into the academic world. There's a lot of benefits to being in academics. And the biggest one that I have found is that I'm surrounded by people that are just totally brilliant. I am like the dumbest one in the office here, right? And so like I have these resources that I can use and bounce ideas off of and feed off of. They really spur creativity and planning and ideas for surgery. And I think that that's my favorite thing about, you know, being in an academic setting. And same with the residents. The residents are like, oh, I have this idea. You know, like, oh, okay, let's try it, you know? And it gives you, you know, some motivation to try something new or something interesting for the purposes of maximum resident benefit. And I think that keeps everything nice and fresh.
That's awesome. This could be a whole other topic, but for those dental students who are applying to oral surgery, what is it that you're looking for as a director? Is there one or two things that you're looking for? What's the most important in your priority list?
Well, I mean, I would say like the most important thing priority wise is, does the person have good character? That's the number one thing. Do they have good character? Because I really don't need a resident that is dishonest or, you know, or someone that just doesn't have integrity. I mean, that's the number one thing. That's very hard to like piece out of an application because all of the applications look extremely similar, particularly with respect to that. I think the next thing that I look for, and I've been asked this several times, is can you teach? Because from my perspective, I can't teach all of the residents everything. Number one, I'm not an expert in everything. Okay. Like I'm not an expert in, like I'm an expert in what I'm an expert in. I can teach anybody gender affirmation surgery or facial aesthetic surgery, but I'm not an expert in a lot of areas of oral and maxillofacial surgery. And I shouldn't be the one teaching you that. So anything that a resident that has a particular interest in, I'm hoping that they will teach the other residents that. Right. Mm-hmm. So they have a particular interest in like doing these like very intensive implant grafting cases with all on whatever and all on this and like, the, you know, deal with the prosthodontist and the planning. Like, I hope that they are so interested in it that they give a presentation on it because I cannot teach that. And there's no way to teach every little thing to every person. So what I teach to a chief resident, I hope gets filtered down to the lower level residents. Like you can't teach 18 residents the same thing over and over again. They're not all in the operating room with you. And so I really look for someone that will disseminate the information they get, not just from me, but from all of the attendings, right? So that everybody is well-trained, equally trained, and we can be confident in everyone's skills that leave here. And so if you're a dental student and you're like, yeah, I like to keep the information for myself and I don't like to teach, you know, it's not very valuable to my program, right? It's that the most valuable thing to me is someone that really wants to get their hands in with the interns and show them stuff.
Yep. I like that. That's one I haven't heard or considered, is having that ability and that desire maybe to teach. Is that's awesome.
Now everybody's going to come and interview and be like, oh, I love to teach.
Yeah.
I'm going to get a lot of, I've divulged my secrets.
Exactly.
The secret to getting into UNC Olomaxofacial Residency Program, be a good teacher. I think, you know, the last thing that I look for a lot of the time is someone that has had like a job in the service industry. To be in the service industry where I'm like the equal footing, you're mopping floors or you're waiting tables or something like that, that really changes your perspective on all of the patients that you encounter and how hard their work is. I think having a job in the service industry teaches you what it's like to show up every single day and see people that you work with side by side who may actually be higher than you, like a manager for you. And, you know, we all prize this like golden education that we have, but sometimes we overlook like just great qualities in people that have service level jobs. And it's important to have friends and relationships in service level industry.
Yeah, that's excellent. The first point of having good character, I mean, that's probably something that you can't change easily. You know, you are who you are.
I will tell you that the one thing that I see, you know, for good character is if you're an Eagle Scout, if people are like, oh, I don't know if I should put that because that was from when I was like in high school or whatever. I'm like, no. Pretty much every Eagle Scout I've met has good character.
Well, that's true. I'm an Eagle Scout, by the way.
Oh, you are? Oh, I know that. Okay, well, you can apply to UNC if you want to redo residency.
I'm good on that one. Oh, my gosh. Any other words of wisdom you have for our listeners out there?
Going back to gender affirmation surgery, which I really love, I will tell you that for those listeners out there, this is totally in your wheelhouse, okay? This is like your area. This is the head and neck and facial skeleton are you. And we need more surgeons to do and be competent in this surgery. This is an area where oral and maxillofacial surgeons should move into, should expand the scope, and should be the primary surgeon for this. And what you're doing for these patients that need gender-affirming surgery is completely life-changing for them. Not just in the sense that you improve their feelings of gender dysphoria and help them through a process that has been difficult for them for sometimes, you know, 20, 30, 40 years of their life, but also when transgender patients go into the community and are passing as the gender that they prefer to be, they are at significantly less risk of violence in the community. There's many studies that have shown that patients, you know, women that dress as women but were born male, if they are not passing in the community, are at very high risk for violence in the community setting and suicide. And so we're doing a lot of good by doing this surgery. And it's something that, again, is a large, large population of the U.S. population you don't think of, the same number of people that have type 1 diabetes.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that and for sending that message out there, because it's so critical, and we don't hear that very often, so very helpful. We end every podcast with 4 rapid-fire questions.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. Are you okay if I ask you that? So first question is, what is the best book you've read in the past year?
I really loved Educated by Tara Westover. That was a really interesting book about growing up in Idaho and her life after that, which is fascinating.
No, I haven't heard that. So it's called Educated?
Yeah, Educated by Tara Westover. It's an interesting read. It's like a memoir of her life. It's a really cool book. What else? I love, you know, Thinking Fast and Slow, What the Dog Saw. I mean, I'm sort of in a voracious reader at nighttime.
Excellent. Have you read David and Goliath?
Yes.
Malcolm Gladwell.
Book? Yeah, that's a great book. Yeah, it really teaches you to sort of recognize that there's sort of another way around, right? And that the one that looks like they're going to be in charge, like, may have incapacities that you are more easily overcome than you think, I guess.
Yes. Next question is, what has been the most helpful non-oral surgery thing you've done in your life that helps you with your daily oral surgery skills?
Yeah, so I'm going to go back to working in the service industry. So okay. I waited tables for a long time. I think that that is really important to learning how to interact with people, talk with people, have people talk to you in a not nice way, you know, be completely disrespected and just go to the next table and have it be fine. So I think it gives you a lot of thick skin, like you were talking about, how to get by.
This next question may not be pertinent to you. I don't know if you extract teeth anymore.
I do.
If you were going to extract tooth number 14, which forceps would you use?
I only ever use 3 forceps, maybe 4. So I use an upper universal for 14.
Okay.
The only other forceps I ever use are a lower universal, an ash, and a cow horn. And I hardly ever use a cow horn. So like if you just
really?
Put an upper universal, a lower universal, and an ash on my tray, 99% of the time, that's what I'll use.
You're good. Okay. Excellent. Good to know. And then the last question is, what is your favorite quote?
Oh, my favorite quote. You know what? I keep it here. It's kind of long. Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Okay. I write it in my little book so I can refer to it. This is from Marianne Williamson. I don't even know who that is, but it starts like this. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others.
Awesome. That's so great. What do you like most about that quote?
Generally, most people feel like, I think most people's deepest fear is that they are in some way inadequate. And the reality is that your deepest fear is that you are not doing what you are potentially able to do. And so it's just a difference in the frame of mind.
Yep. Well said. Yeah, maybe my deepest fear is that I'm not contributing enough to this profession and helping it go forward. And that's one of the reasons why I created the podcast, because I want to get rid of that fear.
Well, that, I think this podcast is awesome. I'm so impressed with people that can project on social. I don't have any social media presence, you know, that can do podcasts that, you know, that just really put themselves out there. It's really super impressive. I like to hide in my little hole.
I totally get it. Well, you've come out of your hole in this regard, and we really appreciate you doing that. Thank you so much for sharing your experience as a director and as a surgeon, you know, doing these great cosmetic procedures. Wish you the best. Are you okay if our listeners contact you with questions about this?
Absolutely. Elda.Fisher@unc.edu. You can contact me anytime. I would love to hear from everybody. Criticisms, everything. I'll take it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Elda, and I really appreciate your time.
It's been awesome, Grant. Thank you so much for the invitation. You run a great podcast, and it's definitely contributing to the world of oral and maxillofacial surgery.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I would also love it if you would connect with us on Instagram and Facebook through our Everyday Oral Surgery pages. It's great to hear feedback. We've received many great comments, and I found a lot of good interviewees through people contacting me after the podcast. If you are an oral and maxillofacial surgeon, or you know someone that is, and you think they would be a good candidate to be on this podcast, or you would like to be on the podcast, please, please reach out to me. You can reach me at my email, which is grantstuckey@gmail.com, or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Also, if you have any topics that you'd like to hear discussed, please email me as well, and I'll get those reviewed in the future. I am supremely grateful for everyone who does reach out to me and let me know what their thoughts are on the podcast. I'm constantly striving to improve each episode and to advance the overall learning of all of us in this tremendous field of oral surgery. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you on the next episode.